The pride, passion, and pageantry of college football lives here. This is the Paul Feinbaum Show, Hour 3 Podcast.
We're celebrating Juneteenth, of course, today and all weekend, and we are delighted to welcome all of you back to the program. This next story is truly extraordinary, and we are delighted to welcome David Dennis Jr., who is a very prominent writer, to the program, who with his father has collaborated on a book, The Movement Made Us, A Father, A Son, and the Legacy of a Freedom Ride. David, thank you. Thank you so very much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you on not only Father's Day, but on the eve of Juneteenth to tell a story that really is remarkable. You've lived it. Those of us who are learning about it are just marveling. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me.
When you grow up around something like this, maybe it seems obvious to me, but when learning more about the story, it doesn't seem so easy or obvious. So your father was a very prominent civil rights leader. He was part of the Freedom Rides in the 60s that helped to try to right some of the most horrific wrongs in American history. But that's his story. But your story is a little bit different. You grew up, became a very, very well-respected and prominent writer. How did you, number one, deal with everything that he had done? He was your dad, but he was also somebody that was a hero to many, and then finally figure out a way to get this into a book.
Yeah, I mean, I had heard his stories growing up, him sitting around with his peers in the movement, and them sitting around the table and talking about what it was like and the things they experienced. So this book is an oral history of my dad's time and from 1961 to 64, but really also talking about my experience of being his son. And, you know, he dealt with some really traumatic things, you know, coming out of that. Survivor's guilt. A lot of his friends did not make it. His best friend was Megar Evers. Goodman Chaney and Schwerner were dear friends of his. And he lost friends along the way. So it was just trying to unpack that relationship, what this movement, you know, created between us and generationally, what it made me as a husband and father myself. So there was a lot of healing going on in this book, but it's also understanding some of the things that he had to go through and a lot of other folks had to go through in this country.
Yeah, sometimes you can almost be too close to something, David, but as you were growing up, I mean, you're a young guy, the world was different, thank goodness. It still had a long way to go, but as you heard these stories and became old enough to understand, how did you approach it? Because he still was your dad, after all.
Yeah, I mean, I had to be sort of delicate because I was tapping into some memories that he had locked away for a long time. There are some things in this book that he had forgotten until I found the information and found the research and showed him that he was at these places. But at the same time, just as, you know, what we wrote about in that book was so long ago, I mean, we were writing this in the middle of the 2020 protests after the killing of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery. And so a lot of the things that happened in the 60s feel like it echoes to now. So at some parts, I feel like I was writing a book, you know, it's written in first person. It's my dad's voice. And there are parts in here that feel like I'm, you know, writing as if I were in the 60s. And sometimes it's really hard to tell the difference, which is a sobering and you know, sort of depressing fact. But at the same time, you know, we're trying to glean some hope from what they did in the 60s and some hope from what a lot of folks did in 2020 when they, you know, fought for change themselves.
David Dennis Jr. with us, who wrote the book with his father. It's been 2 years now since that moment. And I'm curious how your father saw that unfold, because it was, there have not been many moments in these last 60 years that have touched as many people as the showing of that video and then the reaction that summer.
That was extremely difficult for my father to watch, you know, that police officer, you know, kill George Floyd. I mean, for my dad, he had been exposed to and experienced and heard a lot of violence and death in the 60s. But obviously, technology was different. There were not cell phones back then to cover these killings of Medgar Evers and Herbert Lee and Goodman Chaney and Schwerner and folks like that. So you just sort of heard about it. But what happened to my dad is that for the first time, he saw the agony in George Floyd and saw the agony that his friends went through at the time. And so it made it really painful for him. And it was painful for me to see my dad go through that. I mean, I've asked him a lot of times, you know, when you were doing this in the 60s, did you think we would still be having these issues? Did you think that you would have a son and a grandson who, when they drive, may get pulled over and, you know, killed by police or something like that? Like, did you think that was possible? And, you know, he didn't. He thought that that wouldn't be happening. So it was really hard to be writing this in the middle of all that, that tumultuous time.
David, through this book, you take us back to that period. And I don't think, I mean, young people today, they see the video. But mm-hmm. you lay out how truly brutal and awful it was. And anyone who understands history knows that. But time tends to push it so deep into the crevices. What was it like to hear it firsthand? Again, not as a father to a young person, but to somebody who was collaborating with a book.
I mean, I had heard these stories in very broad strokes growing up and did not understand. You know, my dad and his friends, when they get together and they talk about this, they laugh about it, they play the dozens, but they sort of hide the more gruesome, more brutal parts. And so doing the research, talking to my dad, talking to other people like, you know, Jerome Smith and Yvester Simpson and Don Hubbard, people who were in the trenches and in the middle of some brutal, brutal moments, it really sort of illuminated to me just what they went through, but also at the same time, just what they achieved, understanding what they were up against and how they turned that into, you know, creating democracy in the country for the first time is a really inspirational story, in spite of the fact that it was really, really difficult to listen and you know, go through the files and understand just exactly how painful this was for so many people.
David, what inspired your father to become involved and to see this through back then?
Well, he wanted a date, to be honest. He was, he was a freshman at Dillard, which is a HBCU in New Orleans. And he saw a young lady out there trying to get people invested in coming to help out with the Congress of Racial Equality in New Orleans. And her name was Doris Castle. My dad had no interest, no intention of joining any sort of movement or going to jail. He wanted to go to school and become an engineer, but he wanted to take this young lady on a date. And she said, the only way we're going on a date is if you come to these meetings. And sort of one thing led to another. He goes to these meetings. They get him to start doing protests. He gets arrested. And it slowly sort of creeps up until he ends up at the Freedom Rides and decides, you know, I'm going to go on this bus, despite the fact that, you know, I might not make it on the other side. But it did all start with my dad trying to get a date with a dynamic woman and movement organizer, Doris Castle, which, spoiler alert, my dad never did get to go on that date. So
that's truly a moment of levity at a time when there wasn't much mm-hmm. laughing. You mentioned Medgar Evers, and certainly he was really one of the most important and tragic moments of this entire time. Take us back with your dad and him and so many other brave people during this period.
Yeah, so Medgar Evers, so my dad started his movement work in Louisiana and then moved into Jackson to do movement work in Jackson. And the first person that he was told you have to meet is Medgar Evers. I mean, Medgar Evers had made his mark in that state in Mississippi from the beginning. I mean, he was investigating the Emmett Till lynching. He was, you know, a prominent figure. And so they just ended up becoming extremely close to the point where my dad was with Medgar Evers the night he was killed. You know, and Medgar Evers said was going to go watch the Kennedy speech. My dad jokingly is what they did. They joked with each other about how close they came to death. My dad said, you know, look, I'm not going to ride with you. Somebody's going to get killed riding with you. And they laughed it off and went home. And that was the night that Medgar Evers, was assassinated. And that changed the movement forever. I mean, that was an assassination in a way that they hadn't seen before. And it really, illuminated the fact that these people are, you know, they're getting murdered. Like, white supremacy in Mississippi was murdering folks, prominent people in front of their homes. And that changed everything. And my dad is still struggling with the survivor's guilt of having made it through that.
And David, to state the obvious, nobody was doing anything about it in Mississippi. I mean, and you were at risk, certainly, you know, what happened in Philadelphia with the civil rights workers, what happened everywhere. I mean, it took a long time to learn how truly terrible and ghastly this was. Living there in the moment, how did your father deal with that?
Sadly, I mean, there was not time to deal with that. You know, you were just going from one thing to the next, and there wasn't any time to really heal. There were no breaks. Dad didn't have any vacations for you know, that time, the entire time he was in the movement. It was just survival. You know, like these, an example of the way these things pile on each other, you know, when Medgar Evers was assassinated at the same time, Fannie Lou Hamer and activists were being tortured in Winona, Mississippi. So these events just pile on each other, and they're kids. My dad was in this book, is 20 years old up until he's 23 years old. Like, these are children going through this. So when you ask how they coped back then, they didn't. They just had to survive, and they're still dealing with PTSD and trying to cope with it now. I think this book helped my dad heal. It helped him cope with it. But, you know, there was no sort of understanding of self-care, therapy, and things like that. It's, you know, comparable to a war. You know, my dad calls himself, he says he was a war general, and this was pretty much a war. I mean, there were bombings and assassinations and spies and beatings and torture and things like that. Like, they were fighting a war where there was no home base, where you could get killed in front of your own house. So there was no, you know, the idea of how they get through it is just survival.
Yeah, and I mean, so many other things happened after that. Of course, you know, Dr. King assassinated a couple years later, and today, as you reflect on the encounter with your dad, I'm you're a writer, a very accomplished writer, and extremely well respected. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm sure I would have felt a lot of pressure making sure we got this right.
Yeah, there was a ton of pressure. I mean, I wanted my dad to feel well represented, but also I wanted his peers to feel well represented. I want this movement to feel well represented. These are stories that are not often told. And one of the most important things is that there are names in here of people who you just don't see in history books. You know, we know about Medgar Evers and a lot of ways, you know, we know, obviously know about Martin Luther King, and we know about Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner being killed. And a lot of folks, you know, not enough, a lot of folks do know about Mrs. Hamer, but there are so many names of people in this book who need to be spoken. C.O. Chin and Maddie Bivens, you know, Doris Castle, Aretha Castle, and those names, and bringing those names to the forefront was the part that was extremely important to me, making sure that Black women who were the engine of this movement and continue to be the engine of any liberation movement are represented. So those were the things that were really important to me, that the folks who, you know, were central in getting us free and this, you know, freedom movement were the ones that names get put in the book as much as humanly possible. So there was a lot of pressure to make sure that happened.
Name of the book, The Movement Made Us, A Father, A Son, and the Legacy of a Freedom Ride, with David Dennis Jr. and, of course, his dad. What a pleasure to have you here. Thank you for making the time, and all the very best.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Wow, what an incredible, extraordinary story here on this Friday before the Father's Day, and especially Juneteenth, as we reflect back.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
Is your schedule too packed to see a doctor about your erectile dysfunction? Well, with Hims, now you can get treated for ED without stepping foot outside your door. They're changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. Hims provides access to doctor-trusted ED treatment options such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and entirely online. Just answer a series of questions and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option. If prescribed, your medication ships to you free. No insurance needed. So what are you waiting for? Join the hundreds of thousands of trusted Hims subscribers and get treated. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/Paul. That's HIMS.com/Paul for your personalized ED treatment options. HIMS.com/Paul. Hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies on product and subscription plan.
And we are back. Let's continue with more phone calls. Willie is up next in Mississippi. Hey, Willie.
Hey, how are you doing today?
We are doing well. Thank you.
Hey, guys, I just heard your show. You know, I lived in Mississippi 40 years ago, and I came out to the Pacific Northwest on a football scholarship. And we were pioneers. We were the first two, me and my roommate, junior college football, to come out to Oregon. But I was born and raised on a plantation in the northwest part of Mississippi. It was called Sherrick Plantation. And you hear a lot of folklore about the crossroad where the blues started at. That's right down in there, Tupelo, Mississippi, where sure. Elvis was born. Well, I was born right in that mecca. I was born 6.6 miles from the crossroad. That's where intersection 49 and 61 intersect with one another. And that's where people leave the state of Mississippi from that destination, the train station and the bus station that intersect right there, Highway 49 and 61. But growing up on that plantation in the Mississippi Delta, Sherrick Plantation, that was at my peak earliest years as a youth, there were over 750 families on the Sherrick Plantation, and there was 10 kids per household. And on those plantations, there were schools, and there were churches that were stored. And so those plantations were self-sufficient. And so those people never left the plantation. I know people right now, there's four guys that I know I grew up with, they're still living on that plantation, but they don't work like they did then. The plantation owners just left them land. But my family, 300 years of slavery on the plantation, but grew up in that plantation life. But during that time period, where I grew up at, there was 9 plantations. Sherrick, Hull, Lowndes, Mississippi. All these plantation owners had these huge network of income. You know, now that I know about it, I'm an adult and I can look back at it, I can reflect on some things that, it just brings chills to my eyes to my heart, because you have to survive. You have to understand how to survive. And my mom and dad couldn't read or write, but they understood certain things that could keep you alive. And every kid on every one of those plantations knew that. So they knew how to stay out of trouble, the ones that knew how to stay out of trouble. But the plantation life was self-sufficient. We had traditions, and people were strong during that time period, but I can just see the differences, because when Nigga Everett got killed, I got a brother the same age as him. And you look at the map, if you look at the longitudinal coordinates, it's like 10 miles apart. He was 15 years old when Nigga was 13, and he left the state of Mississippi because it scared him so bad. But these things that went on in the Delta as a young youth, you know, understanding the people that you go with, information is going to carry from tradition to tradition. My mom couldn't read or write, but she could cook 300 recipes, and she could make, I know my mom made German beer. And we don't know how she made it. She made several types of wine. She was the head cook at the elementary school. But there were people in the Mississippi Delta on those plantations that had different characteristics that carried with their kids throughout their life. And my mom, I didn't know the things that were happening. I didn't know who were politicians and who was leaders, because they didn't raise us that way. They raised us to love, care, protect, and do the best you can do. And I was a numbers guy. I had no idea. You know, when I graduated, I got a scholarship out to Oregon. I finished there in Oregon, and I've been an aerospace engineer for the last 39 years of my life. But you can't help but reflect the shit that went down. And as you mature and get old, you understand those types of things. But then you have to get out of respect to those parents who were diligent, they were hard, they had to understand. understand the ecosystem. They couldn't read or write. You think God going to tell people because they can't read or write? I'm not going to let you in heaven. But I just want people to know, people live, they survive, and they understand the nature of life. And I just, all I want to say, these types of things are being found out because the natural things that go on with technology, we're finding out things that we never knew in the past. But I just say, I'm a strong American, I'm a Black American, I'm a proud American. And that's all I got to say. I just wanted to share that because I don't know if people knew that these type of people lived in the state of Mississippi and people migrated from different places all over the world. And that's what happened to me in 1981. And I just wanted to thank this show allowing me to talk about this.
Willie, thank you very, very much for sharing that story. That's just absolutely remarkable. Thank you. Appreciate it. Philip is up next. Hey, Philip.
Hey, Paul. I was listening to you talking to the guy about the book. And then that gentleman that you just talked to, you know, I've watched your show for years. And, you know, you've got a lot of judgmental people on there, a lot of angry people that call in. And you know what? They're talking about this kid that come to Tennessee that they paid, you know, that he's getting $8 million for. You know, that's my choice. That's that kid's choice. That's where he chose to play ball at. You know, whether he got the money or not, you know, why does people worry about that? Oh, and by the way, I hope you have a wonderful Father's Day, but people need to mind their business and learn respect when it comes to these kids, because these kids is what makes these colleges, and stop being so angry and judgmental. And every now and again, you know, step up, give a little faith to a player. You know, give gratitude where it deserves and stop sticking your nose in stuff that where it don't belong and do the right thing. Because you know what? When it's all said and done, it's not the money. It's not the college. It's the kids.
Philip, thank you very much. We're up against a break. We'll take that now. Come back with more of the program.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
This podcast is proud to be supported by Jet's Pizza, the number one pick in Detroit-style pizza. Why? It's simple. Jet's is better. With the thickest, crispiest, cheesiest Detroit-style pizza in the country, there's no competition. Right now, get $5 off any 8-corner pizza with code 8SAVE. That's the number 8, S-A-V-E. Go to jetspizza.com to learn more and find a location near you. Again, try Jet's signature 8-corner pizza and get $5 off with code 8SAVE. That's the number 8, S-A-V-E. Jet's Pizza. Better because it has to be. Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-hour energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5hourenergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5hourenergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
And welcome back here on a Friday afternoon. You want to give us a ring? We'll take your calls at 855-242-7285. Berner is up next.
Hi, Mr. Paul.
Hey, Berner. Good afternoon.
Hi, yes, sir. How are you doing today? And I sure appreciate your show and all that.
Thank you.
And
thank
I
you
watch
much.
You pretty much all the time, any chance I get if I ain't working.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that.
Yes, sir. My deal is back in the day, my pawpaw and Coy, he was a Black man, and he had his family, and my pawpaw had his family, and they all worked together.
Right.
Everybody worked together back then. There was no racism and nothing. It was about survival. You know what I mean? Everybody worked together to make whatever
now,
do.
Now, Bernard, where did you guys grow up?
Around in Florida, yes, sir.
Okay.
In Florida, and it was so the right deal is when you grow up in school, some of my best friends are, you know, African Americans or Black, however you want to say it.
Whatever
but
you want.
That That's how we were raised here. It's not you owe somebody something.
Right.
This, that, and the other. Every man in America's got the right to be the best he can be. I don't understand.
And what era did you grow up in? What decade?
Panhandle of Florida.
What? Yeah, but Panhandle?
Yes, sir.
And what were the years of your high school days? Just to get some time.
My years of high school was in the 80s.
Yeah. Well, things were a little different in the 80s when our guest dad went to school in the late 50s and 60s, but yeah.
Yes, yeah. But my parents were involved in that, and sure. My grandfather was
absolutely
involved in that.
Absolutely.
And everybody was cool. You know?
Well, Bernard, I think a lot of it depended on where you grew up and when, there was... Yeah, I understand. I grew up in that era before you, but sometimes you don't see it. But some things you just factor in because of the way the times of the day. Thank you very much for the call, Handsome Joe. Good afternoon.
Low tide, roll, fall, fine bomb.
Joe.
And I've got a couple things I want to talk about.
Okay.
And one of them is this AC dude up in New Jersey.
Yeah, he's after you.
I mean, he's obviously calling everybody out. But I got news for AC. There's no, he keeps saying come up to Madison Square Garden, all these places. There ain't nobody down here dumb enough to go to up that neck of the woods no time soon anyway. I mean, and when he talks, he sounds like he's gargling toilet water. I mean, it don't even make sense, Paul. I can't even understand what he's saying besides sledgehammering, getting Madison Square Garden. Other than
ever,
that, I don't know what.
Just out of curiosity, have you ever gargled toilet water?
No. I've heard people doing it when giving them a flushy.
A flushy.
So maybe that's what.
Now hold on. Yeah, I have to ask you this question: what's the difference between a swirly and a flushy?
Well, a swirl in the flush, there's no difference, Paul. But when you're gargling toilet water, the only difference is when you're getting a swirly, you're trying to talk. And that's what AC sounds like. I mean, he sounds like he's talking through toilet water. But I also want to say this to Matt in San Antonio. I think he called me dummy yesterday.
Yeah, he did.
Hey, that little pipsqueak better watch his butt, because you know what? He needs to know his lane and quit trying to poke real men, because I feel sorry for the kid, Paul. I feel sorry for him because he's trying to poke, from all the way out from Texas. He's trying to poke like Legend and me and other folks. I ain't even got no plans to go to Texas either. But I do want to mention this about William and the real attorney in Tennessee. He took up for me, and Paul, I appreciate what he said, because he nailed Augie right on the button Wednesday. He nailed him, Paul, because you don't put down somebody. And I tell you what, I am a good neighbor, and I've got neighbors. I help my neighbors, and they're proud to have me as a neighbor. But Augie put down my whole town when he said, is everybody in Red Bay, if they're like Joe, he don't want to come here. Well, I tell you what, there's not but like 2,500 people in Red Bay, and there ain't one of them that wants Augie to bring his butt to Red Bay. Nobody wants him, because, Paul, not only are they just
Joe,
as good as me, both of them better than me.
Joe, out of curiosity, let's just, for the sake of argument, say that Augie finds his way into Red Bay tomorrow afternoon. If he walked downtown in Red Bay, what kind of reaction do you think he would get?
He'd get a kick to the crotch. I mean, he ain't going to get a welcome mat out, Paul. They're not going to serve him a meal.
A kick to the crotch.
I mean, he'd get a kick to the crotch. And I think even old ladies here are going to kick him in the crotch. I mean, because he's not welcome here. Because what he did is he put down this whole town. And that's something you don't do. And, it's like Augie's in New Orleans. Everybody ain't like Augie in New Orleans. I ain't got to say if everybody's like Augie, I'm not going there. Because
no,
I know everybody's smarter than Augie.
New Orleans is a great
Augie.
City. They're friendly people.
Yeah. It is.
Augie,
and they're all like that.
You know what Augie is. He is.
He's a paralegal.
Well, he is that. But he's an elitist.
He's no attorney, Paul. William in Tennessee is a real attorney. You can tell by the difference in their talks. I mean, he's Augie's one that can't get nobody, you know, to hire him. So he shows up for these people that ain't got no money. You know, public defender. Now, William can make money, defender, and William don't look
public,
down on
public
people.
Public defenders serve a purpose, though. They work for the county, I guess, or the state. They represent indigent, those who are less fortunate.
Well, they tell the person to plead guilty and try to get a less charge.
Right.
That's
well,
what public defenders do.
Most of the time, if I'm accused of murder, I'd rather have somebody other than a public defender. Okay.
That's right. I want like somebody like William up in Tennessee, because he's a good man.
William could get you some. William's a good lawyer. I know William.
I know. And if he can't get me off, he'll probably at least bring me a carton of cigarettes or something.
Here's what Augie could do. They come to you and say, we're coming after the death sentence. And Augie go, hey, what about 99 years in jail? Can we settle on that?
That's what Augie would do. And I have to turn around and kick my counselor right in the crotch if it's Augie.
So,
I'm like, hey, settle on this right here, Augie, and just kick him right in the crotch. I mean, attempt 80-yard field goal to the crotch. That's what Augie needs. And if he ever comes to Red Bay, he's going to get a swirly. But like I said, nobody in here at Red Bay wants Augie to come here. Well, and you are too, Paul. You're welcome here any day of the year because people love you around here. Well, but Augie, they don't nobody like Augie. But Augie, just know this right here, big boy. I'm more handsomer than you are, you dang dummy. Roll Tide, roll, Paul. I am the handsome one.
Well, that sounds like Shakespeare to me.
Yeah.
Wasn't that right after Henry? I am the handsome one.
I am the handsome one.
But yeah, was that the prequel to Hamlet? I think it was.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
10 seconds on the clock. How many things can you name that are always growing? Your relationships, your skills, your customer base. How about businesses on Shopify? Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/network, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/network now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/network.
Back here late Friday afternoon. Moore is up next in Birmingham. Hello, Moore.
Hey there. How are you doing today, Paul?
We're doing great. Thank you.
Good. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I noticed the topic today after I got off from work and just thought I might have a comment on it. First off, my dad passed away when I was young, when I was about 12 or 13, but I remember before then him reading your articles in the Post Herald.
Oh, thank you.
Actually, as he drove down the interstate
back in the old days.
But,
considering how combustible they were back then, that was not a smart thing to do by your dad.
But I called the reason for the topic was my grandfather. He was actually it wasn't called that back then, but Max Bus Systems in Birmingham.
Oh, sure.
He drove from 1944 to 1988.
Wow, he saw a lot.
And yes, sir, and he actually drove the Bessemer route. And I remember him before he passed. He was the greatest man, or actually one of the greatest men beside my dad that I knew. And I even asked him questions growing up. I was like, you know, how was it back then? And because he used to tell me that there was borders and you had to, you know, African Americans had to sit behind
right.
a certain point. And there was no AC on the bus at all the whole time he drove, actually. But he would say, what if they were all full and there was empty seats? And he was like, he'd tell them to have a seat in front of that border, or I don't even know how it was done then. But before he retired, or actually the year he retired, he was given several letters written by the riders that drove in or rode in from Bessemer to Birmingham to work talking about how compassionate and thankful and what a kind man he was. Yes, sir. And I actually still have his old, I think it was made out of wool, or hat that those old bus drivers used to use.
Oh, sure.
Yes, sir. And I remember as a kid,
my friends and I, we'd get on the bus. It was a different time. By the way, I've talked to so many different people from Birmingham during that, not then, but later. Your grandfather was a brave man to do what he did, because most people,
yes, sir.
He took a big risk doing what he did.
And they grew up in Inslee, is where their house was when he raised my mom. And not too far, West End, right off Jefferson Avenue. And then after he was able to earn enough money, they moved over to Bluff Park when the church moved.
Oh, yeah.
And his mortgage went from $50 a month to $100. And he told my mom, or my grandmother, he didn't know how he was going to make his mortgage payment.
No, I mean, I remember thinking about when I grew up, you know, what our house cost. I mean, now they... You could,
yeah, I wish.
Yeah, I mean, it's just truly remarkable to think about how things are different. That's quite a story. That really is an amazing.
But it's just the letters that I got after they passed. My mom actually passed 4 weeks ago yesterday, and I'm the only one left. And it was me and her since my dad died, and like I said, in '98 when I was 12.
Yeah, that's tough.
But I found these letters from these writers still that he had in France.
I don't know more if I've heard a story quite like that, because, first of all, nobody writes letters anymore.
This was in, I believe, 88 when he retired, because it was the BJCTA or whatever they called it. And they gave him a watch with the year that he started and the year that he retired.
So he was in that. How long was he in that job? 44 years.
44.
I mean, think about that. Just think about that today. The number of people who, and some of it's by necessity.
Every day.
I mean, 44 years in the same job, driving a bus.
From Bessemer to Birmingham during that time.
That's a long drive for those who have never been on that route.
Yeah, I think it was a 30 route.
From 3rd Street to 2nd Street. Probably about 30-minute drive.
Yeah, and now that this topic came up, I was just thinking about the time period he in. And like I said, he was a white male, but he went to the war. He was I believe it was Hiroshima.
Yeah, that would have been World War II.
Yes, sir. And around that time period, and he was a Marine too. And whenever he got back, he started driving a bus and never quit.
That's such a great story, and it's the kind of story you don't really hear about. I'm glad we had we mentioned Father's Day. We had a guest on, but that's something you should be. I hope you're incredibly proud of that, and I'm so sorry to hear about your mom passing away.
Yeah, hey, but you gave her a little bit of laughter though at the end of the day, because I've listened to you for the past 15, 20 years, and I would make her listen to it, because I took care of her the last time, going to dialysis 3 times a week. And you finally broke into her, and she started laughing after about 2 or 3 months, and then I could not listen to you. But yes, sir, thank you for letting me tell.
More thank you. I don't know if I'll ever be able to get the memory of your dad reading my articles driving down the street. That's absolutely
in a Cadillac, mind you, to Texas.
That is scary. Thank you very much. Yeah, I was at this event Sunday night in Birmingham. That was a lot of my former colleagues. In the newspaper business, and it's I was a scary person to read. I can assure you, but I just because nothing. I mean, this guy was his dad was probably screaming at the paper as he was driving.
Thank you for listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast. The Paul Feinbaum Show airs weekdays on the SEC Network, beginning at 3 Eastern.